Welcome to the How the Why. With John Barrett Ingalls. Exploring and celebrating the creative process and the creative purpose of authors, editors, and artists that make up and inspire the Black Hill Press family. Black Hill Press is dedicated to the novella. We believe a great story is never defined by its length. Let's get creative.
Hello, and welcome to the How, the Why, brought to you by Black Hill Press. My name is John Barrett Ingalls, and today we are connected with Vincent Scarpa, the managing editor of Austin Review. Vincent, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. I don't know what it's like there in Austin right now, but we have this beautiful pre-Easter 85-degree Los Angeles weather.
Enjoy well, that sounds day. Lovely. I would be lying if I said I'd already left the house today, but it seems like it's nice outside.
That's okay. That sounds
from
like
what
my,
I can gather, looking out the window, it looks lovely.
So you are the managing editor at Austin Review. How long have you been with that journal?
Not terribly long, just a few months. They published a story of mine about a year ago, which I was super happy about. And then earlier this year, Michael Barrett, who's our editor-in-chief, who's a wonderful guy, asked if I would be interested in coming on board, and I said yes.
That's amazing. Let's get a little history of Austin Review. How long have they existed?
Yeah, sure. So they've been around for about 2 years now. 2013 was when the first print issue came out, and we just put out our third print issue, and I've already started taking stories for our fourth issue, which we're hoping to have out this summer.
So it's an annual? You do one a year, or do you do
We're shooting for two a year, but it's you know, it's tough to keep any kind of schedule. But we're shooting for two a year.
So it's a print journal that you take about nine stories per issue?
Yeah, both fiction and nonfiction.
Okay. And what exactly, as your role as the managing editor, what is it that you personally look for when you're looking over submissions?
Right. It's always sort of tough to relay like your aesthetic interest, but I can say that I'm like a sentence level guy, and I really love great syntax and just language that impresses me more than anything else. I think that's what matters to me the most. Language that asserts itself in some way, and stories that are sort of built with rigor and with care. And I think those are, you can tell within the first page or two whether or not that's the story you're reading. And I'm always very delighted to find those stories.
How many submissions do you read through?
A ton, yeah. I think our backlog now is probably like 150 stories. So we're going through a bunch.
And do you tackle them all, or are there a few that, like, after the first page, you're like, okay, this needs a little work, probably not right for us, or do you actually give it the honor of taking it to the end?
I would love to say that I read every submission to the last word, but I do think that within the first 3-4 pages of a 20-page story, you know whether or not the writer is going to be able to pull it off, and just generally if it's the right fit for our magazine or not. We've come across a few great mystery stories and crime fiction that seem well written to me, but just aesthetically don't feel right for us. So we pass on those, but there are also those submissions I think you can tell in the first few sentences that it's just not the right fit.
What would you say is the aesthetic of Austin Review?
Oh man, that's tough. Yeah, well, I what I can say, and maybe Michael would have his own sort of version of this to offer. But again, I think it's just we're interested in stories that present to the reader an opportunity to engage with characters we otherwise wouldn't engage with. We're looking for writing that impresses, for voice that impresses, just something. Yeah, in general, I think we just want to be taken away, right? I mean, that's sort of what we all look to literature for. We want to be escaped from the mundanity of our own lives. So I think that's, I mean, like I said, it's sort of tough to put your finger on why you like what you like. It's sort of like deconstructing a joke, because it becomes less and less funny the more you deconstruct it.
That's how I tell jokes, by the way. So the guy was hanging. No, you don't understand. She didn't want to go.
Yeah, no, those are the best. Those are the best kind of jokes.
So with the nine stories, you like to try to keep some of the submissions local, correct? Like keep Austin alive in a little bit of it?
Yeah, our goal is to always have at least one writer who's either an Austin resident, a former resident, or in some way has strong ties to Austin. And I think we've managed, that hasn't been a problem because there's so much talent in and around the city that it's just a matter of picking one out of it, actually.
Along with Austin Review, you have the online offshoot Spotlight. Was there a pressure, and I remember it's probably existed before you joined in, but was there a pressure to have an online journal as well at the beginning?
Right. No, I think we think of the online section as sort of, because we do get so many great submissions and not everything can fit in the journal, there are still things that we want to publish and we want people to read and we want to publicize. So that's sort of where the online, our Spotlight section comes in, is stories that might not necessarily fit for whatever reason, length, just in terms of time in our next issue, but stuff that we still want our readers to have a chance to read. So that's where we'll put something up on the Spotlight section of our website.
Hmm. And how often do you add new works on the Spotlight?
It's monthly.
Okay. So I like to pretend that we have, you know, millions of listeners. In my head, they're like these young, inspired authors. So for those millions of young, inspired authors who are definitely listening to this podcast right now.
Right.
What is the page count or word count that you look for? What are some of the parameters that they should keep in mind when thinking about submitting to your journal?
So we don't have a hard and fast rule about word count. I think of that as sort of limiting. That being said, after you hit like the 20 page mark, the work really needs to prove its length and earn and warrant that space. And usually for the online section, we're publishing shorter pieces, so maybe 1,000 words, 2,000 words. I totally respect journals who have like a hard and fast word count and page count, but we haven't decided on one just because we don't want to limit anything. But the odds of us publishing a 40-page story are very unlikely.
Right.
Unless that story really does earn every word if it's 40 pages, in which case I'm sure we'd be, you know, thrilled to publish it.
You also like to keep space for a more well-established author as well in each journal?
Yeah, that's our literati section, which that was sort of definitely established before I came on, and we're sort of working on what the place of that might be now for the coming issues. I love the idea of having just good writing in there, regardless of who it's coming from and how established they may or may not be. But that was sort of a choice that was already existing when I came in. So this past issue, we had James Tate, who's a wonderful poet, and then we've got Shayla Haiti, Sam Pink, Mary Miller, really just wonderful writers. And then in this coming issue, we'll have a really wonderful essay from Jeff Stoner, who is my former podcast co-host and has a great book out from Hobart. So we'll have an essay of hers in our next print issue as our literati.
That's very cool. Let's talk. You just brought it up. You know, let's talk about your podcast. I like to celebrate all things podcast.
Yeah,
my first attempt at it. You and Jess had a podcast called Two Birds and One Stoned. How did you start that? And is it kind of on a hiatus now? Or
Right. So, yeah, Jess and I have both worked at one point for American Short Fiction. She was the managing editor there, and I was a reader. And then after we both left ASF, we decided to start this podcast together. We hung out most of the time anyway on her porch talking about books and chain smoking, so we figured we might as well start recording it. And we did, I think, 3 or 4 episodes that we were really pleased with. And then Jess moved to Denver last year, which she's very, very happy there and is doing super well. I miss her terribly here in Austin. So our podcast is on a hiatus insofar as neither of us are technologically inclined in terms of how to record that cross country.
Can give you some tips after our interview if you'd like.
That'd be great because I can barely check my email on my phone. So. we had a really fun time. We got to talk to, we talked to Brett Anthony Johnston, Jen Percy, Leslie Jameson. Really just, it was a really, really fun time. And I have no idea how many people listened to it, but it was super fun for us to do.
Yeah, that's what I say.
I say
there's a million right. people, but maybe like 2 or 3, but really it's
funny.
For me.
That's funny.
You're a writer as well. You were a Norman Mailer College, you won the Norman Mailer College Fiction Award, and you've been published numerous times in multiple journals. Is your job working as a reader or as the new managing editor for Austin Review, does reading all of that content affect the way that you write or affect the way that you write for journals?
Let me think. You know, I think it reading Slush reaffirms what I don't like a lot of the time, which is not a slight against people who are submitting, but just personally, there are things that I look for and I try to pull off in my own writing. And reading Slush, I think, can be a way of, you know, questioning, all right, how good am I at sort of word economy? How good am I at characterization and putting yourself up against, like, you know, against these submissions? But I would also say that I feel like I probably learn more just from reading, you know, short story collections and from reading other literary magazines. At least I learned just as much from doing that and from being a student here at the University of Texas. I'm constantly learning and constantly reevaluating what I think of as my goals in terms of writing short fiction. But I would also say that I don't think I've ever written for a journal. But I have not written to the need of, you know, I want a story in Plowshares, so I want to write the story for Plowshares.
Right.
I think that's a slippery slope and sort of destined for disappointment if someone's doing that. Because no one's getting into Plowshares. I have no intentions of getting into Plowshares.
When you started writing, why was short fiction? I mean, I'm sure you probably have other things that you're working on, but short fiction. Was that what attracted you most while you were in school and when you started
Definitely.
Writing?
Yeah. I was in high school, and I read a Laura Vandenberg short story. It's called Where We Must Be. It's in her first collection of stories. And I just sort of, it's sort of that, like, dark night of the soul, come to Jesus moment where you're like, yeah, this is what I want to do. She pulled it off in 15 pages. Like, why write a novel if you can sort of pull off this effect that I'm so enamored by? And I continue to love the short story. I love its limits. I love its challenges. And I read a bunch of novels and I read a bunch of nonfiction and I write nonfiction as well. But the short story is my first love. And I think reading, gosh, I could list you a million people, but people like Amy Hempel and Lori Moore and Joy Williams and Laura Vandenberg and so many other amazing people, Richard Gates, constantly proves to me that the short story is a form that is incredibly difficult, but also incredibly fascinating. And I love that form so much. And I wish it was more valuable. It doesn't seem to be, but I'll love it forever. It'll always be my first love in terms of writing.
Are you working on compiling a collection yourself?
Yeah, so I'm a second year student at the Mishner Center here in Austin, and my third year is coming up, my last year, so my thesis will be a collection of stories.
Have you thought or attempted anything longer?
I've definitely attempted. I don't know that I excel at it. I think I just have this instinct to always have the end in sight and to always be closing. And I have a hard time convincing myself that somebody wants to read my work for more than 20 pages, that someone would want to sit down with 250 pages.
Right.
And that's probably an issue with my own self-loathing and has nothing to do with writing. But it is sort of difficult for me to open up space in fiction rather than sort of be closing it.
Now, how do you go about approaching your short story? So you come up with an idea or a character or whatever. Are you an outliner? Or are you somebody who just likes to sit down and start writing it out?
Yeah, I'm definitely not an outliner. I would probably benefit from being one, but old habits die hard, and it's not the way that I go about it. It usually starts with a first sentence that will sort of stick with me for, you know, a few days, a few weeks, a few months, a few years, and then at some point I will be forced by deadline to have a story in for workshop or for something, and then it usually sort of just comes out in one long rush. It'll be like 3 or 4 days of staying up very late and getting very little sleep, not at all glamorous, and then I will have a draft that I'm at least pleased with, and then there's some sentence level revision that goes on after, but once I sit down to start, I usually have the story fully formed in my head. It's just a matter of translating it.
Hmm. Do your stories ever surprise you as you're writing them then without the outline? Are you ever like, oh, I didn't expect it to take that turn, but we'll go with it?
Yeah, I think tonally I'm not surprised because I have a good sense of what I want the tone to be. But there are definitely times where I'll get to what I thought would be the ending and it'll feel feel insufficient for the story that's preceded it, and something new will offer itself. And that is always a delight, I think, as a writer to come across those moments. Although I will say they are rare. I usually do. I'm pretty attached to what I've been thinking of for 3 months, perhaps to my own detriment. but I do get attached to the idea.
You mentioned deadline and approaching deadlines. Are those deadlines imposed from school, or they self-imposed deadlines that you have?
Oh yeah, they're from school, either for workshop or for parts of our thesis that we have to turn in, and then also if someone is kind enough to solicit me for a magazine and I have nothing, that's a great deadline too. But I'm terrible at self-imposing deadlines. I would get nothing done, I don't think, without them.
Well, I'm wondering because, you know, I suffer from the same, you know, like more prolific in a setting where somebody's expecting something from me, but when it's just me, it's hard to get that voice in my head screaming and yelling, get off your ass.
Right.
So what do you think is going to happen out after school, after those outside imposed deadlines? And
I mean, gosh, you've just articulated all my fears and what's keeping me up at night. I have enough faith in myself that I can still get the work done. It might be a matter of forcing myself into deadlines and adjusting to that. Because when no one's expecting anything of you, then there's no one sort of to let down. And that's sort of what motivates me, is that I don't want to let somebody down. So maybe just being more invested in my own success and not in the opinions of others would get me some work done afterwards.
That's an interesting notion.
Yeah, I think that's sort of like a good propelling force, is you don't want to disappoint somebody who's asked something of you. But I don't, you know, I sort of don't give a shit if I write anything or not. But the inspiration, I think, is sort of always there. And usually if I read a really great collection, I'm sort of propelled to at least sit down at the computer and toy with an idea. So right. As long as I keep being stimulated by writing, which will never not be the case, I think that I will also be writing. And if I probably should stop smoking as much pot as I do too, and I'll probably get a lot more done that way as well.
We, with Black Hill Press, we started at the beginning of this year a project called Routinology, where we're studying the routines of different creatives, and then having them, you know, talk a little bit about what they need to prepare, what they need when they're sitting down in front of their computer. What is their routine for their creative process? Would you mind sharing a little bit about your routine? You may have already, about smoking pot and staying inside. But would you mind sharing a little bit about your routine for your creative process, or even your routine for sitting down with Slush Pile?
Sure, yeah. It is definitely not an approach that I advise others to take up, because I have tons of other friends who get a lot more done than I do, just in terms of, you know, they start much earlier. I'm a night owl. I usually don't, if I'm working on a story, I might not start till 10 or 11 at night. And then I'll be up sort of till 4:30, 5:30, and then sort of sleep the day away, which is not a great schedule. And I don't encourage it. But there's a lot of chain smoking. There's a lot of pacing in my apartment. A lot of just chastising myself for not being better at this by now. A lot of listening to Bjork in anger. Some ironing, some sweeping, just anything to sort of give myself a small task to complete in the middle of this much larger one. And then, yeah, smoking a lot of pot, that sort of has been helpful for me. But yeah, I'm very envious of writers who can set aside, you know, 8 a.m. to noon and work that way and sit down that way. I'm not there yet. I'm so antsy and I'm easily distracted.
I've talked to people as well. I wake up every morning at 5 and drink coffee and go for it. I'm like, my God, what am I doing wrong?
Yeah, and then they go for a run and still manage to get all this other shit done. It's amazing to me. I need a nap after I do like 2 errands. So I'm in all of these people.
Yeah, I need a nap after I get up and drink my coffee.
Yeah.
Well, Vincent, thank you so much for joining us. It was a lot of fun talking to you.
Oh, of course. Thank you so much for having me.
And, you know, again, for all of those listeners out there, go and check out Austin Review and The Spotlight is their online version, and go look at Two Birds and One Stone. Hear some. There's, how many did you do? How many podcasts? 3 or 4?
I think we did 4. Yeah,
they're great. They're a lot of fun. Seems like you could tell that you guys get along really well. And thank you again.
Of course, of course.
This has been the How the Why by Black Hill Press. I'm your host, John Barrett Ingalls. The show is produced by Kevin Stanek and yours truly, with production assistance by Sarah Becker. The music is Maya Lua by Bossa Zuzu. I wanted to thank everybody for your creativity and your inspiration, and to remind you all to keep making art. Thank you.